The Federal Communications Commission tried to craft rules aimed at preserving the open internet. Then last month, a federal appeals court struck down those rules. The FCC announced yesterday that it would not appeal that ruling. Instead, it will try to come up with a new set of rules. NPR's Joel Rose reports.
The FCC has tried to make sure that broadband providers treat all traffic on their networks equally. That would mean they can't block or slow access to the internet or charge certain content companies like, say, Netflix or Amazon more for faster service. The commission came up with rules 4 years ago, but they were overturned by an appeals court in Washington, which said the FCC lacked the legal authority to enforce them. FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler says the agency will try again to come up with rules it can enforce, but Republican critics, including FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai, say the agency is meddling in the free market.
It reminds me a little bit about the movie Groundhog Day, and I'm generally skeptical that this effort will end up any differently from the last one in 2010.
Critics on the left aren't happy either. Craig Aaron is president of the nonprofit consumer advocacy group Free Press. He and others say the FCC would have a stronger legal case if it moved to reclassify broadband under a tougher type of regulation faced by phone companies. Aaron is disappointed that the agency seems unwilling to take that step.
I think it's a short-sighted decision that seems to be easier now politically, but in the long run really poses a lot of danger to the free and open internet.
Big cable and telecom companies have made no secret that they would fight to avoid that kind of reclassification, and they have powerful friends on Capitol Hill. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
A lot of people this morning might be asking, what's up with that? Facebook is paying $19 billion for a messaging service called WhatsApp. This dwarfs the $1 billion Facebook paid for the photo sharing app Instagram, and it may be signaling an arms race among tech companies for mobile technology. NPR's Laura Seidel joins us now to explain why Facebook is paying so much for what is basically an app. Good morning.
Good morning.
What exactly is it? WhatsApp.
Right. WhatsApp. So as the name suggests, it's an app now worth $19 billion. You can download it to your mobile phone for free, and it taps into your phone book and lets you easily text message with your friends on the app. And by doing this, you can avoid facing data cap plans for your cell phone from your cell phone company or international charges if you're texting with somebody who's outside the country.
Is it worth it? $19 billion?
Well, Facebook obviously thinks so. The app is not that well known in the U.S., but it is growing very fast in Europe, India, and Latin America. Currently, it has 450 million users. That's twice as many users as Twitter, and it's growing by more than 1 million new accounts a day. Now, in a conference call, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg noted that it's the only app that's grown faster than Facebook ever did. And key to that growth is the coveted youth demographic, which has been losing interest in Facebook. So this is a way to get them back. And WhatsApp has a lot of people outside of the U.S., in Europe, India, and Latin America. And Facebook needs to grow there because its growth is slowing in the United States. Facebook is also putting a big push into the world of mobile. And this app acquisition is part of its effort to improve its mobile services.
Well, a lot of people, though, Laura, do seem to think Facebook is paying way too much.
Yeah, I actually had an analyst wonder what kind of drugs they were taking at Facebook. But anyway, Facebook is basically paying about 10% of its value for this company. And among the reasons people question the price is that it's basically an instant messaging app, and people don't have to invest a lot of time signing up for an instant messaging app like you do when you sign up for Facebook and you put in information and pictures. So it's just as easy to sign up as it is to drop it. Facebook also uses an advertising model, and the founders of WhatsApp have really stayed away from that model. In fact, the co-founder is a Ukrainian immigrant named Jan Koum, who fled anti-Semitism and anti-authoritarian government in the Ukraine with his mom when he was 16. He came from a small town, and he actually has a distaste for advertising. So WhatsApp has a $1 a year subscription model, and there could be some cultural disconnect between the two companies down the line.
So is Facebook likely to change WhatsApp?
Well, for now, Facebook says it's not going to change anything. The emphasis here is on growth, not revenue, getting more and more people to sign up. So users aren't likely to notice a shift at this time.
And Laura, finally, do you think this is this price tag does suggest an arms race in the tech world?
Well, sort of an arms race. What we don't know for sure is whether other companies were bidding on WhatsApp, but I think we can guess that they probably were. So there was a bidding war going on. And one of the things that you see happening is there are a lot of startups in the tech world right now, and companies like Facebook and Google want world domination, essentially. So it bids up the price if they see something that's really vibrant. And as for whether or not this is a good or bad purchase, remember when Google purchased YouTube for $1.6 billion, everybody thought they'd overpaid because YouTube wasn't making any money. But look what's happened. YouTube is wildly profitable. So someday we may say that Mark Zuckerberg was a visionary by buying WhatsApp.
Laura, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's Laura Seidel.
Yesterday, Facebook bought a little startup for a lot of money, $19 billion in cash and stock. It's hard to fathom a price tag that big. Half the companies in the S&P 500 aren't worth that much. But a look at who exactly is using the application called WhatsApp may explain the value that Facebook sees in it. Here's more from Arthi Shahani of member station KQED in San Francisco.
A few months back, Mark Zuckerberg gave a talk that foreshadowed yesterday's big news. On stage at a popular tech conference, the CEO said, yes, Facebook did hit the goal of connecting 1 billion users around the world, but there's a lot more work to do to connect everyone else.
Now the focus for us is actually kind of retooling, and you're going to see us retooling the company in a lot of ways to go take on a lot of harder problems that fulfill this mission. So, for example, connecting the next 5 billion people. It's going to be really hard because a lot of them don't have internet access.
WhatsApp, the company Facebook just bought, is getting around that problem by using less internet. The app rides on the coattails of traditional phone carriers, bypasses their expensive texting services, and lets people send instant messages for free. 450 million users are on it, including technology writer Om Malik. He chats with his elderly mom in India, and she converted him to the app.
It is one of those things which starts out as a way to save money, but in the end, it turns out to be a social glue for all of us.
WhatsApp has really cute emoticons and even emoji animals like a baby tiger. But does that make it worth $19 billion? Analyst Nathan Eagle with Jhana Mobile explains why he thinks it does.
Facebook is an emerging market company, ultimately.
Zuckerberg is an American with global ambitions. The co-founder of WhatsApp, Jan Koum, is a first-generation immigrant who grew up in an emerging market, Ukraine. That country is rocked by political violence and bloodshed. Other emerging market countries, while more stable, struggle with problems like corruption and no electricity at times. But where most of us see instability, some Silicon Valley giants see economic promise.
Within the next 3 years or so, the majority of Facebook's revenue is going to be coming from emerging markets. I mean, it's certainly not coming in from North America or Western Europe, for that matter.
Jhana Mobile conducted a small survey in emerging market countries and found that in India, Brazil, and Mexico, people use WhatsApp way more than Facebook to send messages. So whether you call the purchase defense or offense, the point is
they're really doubling down, and it's frankly the right call.
Analyst Rob Enderle has a different take.
Massively overpriced.
Enderle totally agrees that there's lots of money to be made in emerging markets. But he says WhatsApp doesn't have a firm leg to stand on. Telecom carriers in other countries who have to spend lots of money to build radio towers and networks will take exception to these dirt-cheap products coming out of America.
The carriers can always step in and say, we'll just do the same thing and you're done because they're much closer to the customer. I mean, why would we need WhatsApp if you didn't have to pay extra for instant messaging?
Enderle says all the buzz from yesterday's acquisition might get those carriers finally making a move to kill the startup competition. For NPR News, I'm Arthi Shahani in San Francisco.
Facebook has just offered billions for the messaging company WhatsApp. It's the latest in a string of record acquisitions by Silicon Valley tech giants. In recent months, Facebook has also begun quietly investing in research. NPR's Jeff Bromfield reports on its new venture into artificial intelligence.
Until recently, Jan LeCun was just another computer scientist at New York University. He specialized in trying to get computers to think more like people, Most of us know it as artificial intelligence.
It's an obsession that goes back a very long time.
The goal of AI is to make computers that interact with people as if they were people too. But at the moment, LeCun is focused on a smaller part of that goal, getting computers to recognize things the way we do. Computers already recognize some things. Take the scanner at the supermarket. You swipe your block of cheese and the scanner reads the barcode.
$6.99.
But when you think about it, that's a pretty limited kind of recognition. Try scanning something that doesn't have a barcode. I don't know, a cat.
Unexpected item in bagging area.
Jan LeCun is trying to create a computer program that can recognize things without barcodes, things it hasn't seen before. Show his program a cat. And the program sees nose, whiskers, ears, and takes a guess. The first time, it might guess dog, but you tell it wrong, cat. It figures out what it did wrong.
And then it adjusts so that next time around that it sees the same image, it will give you a better answer.
This is the key thing about LeCun's program. It learns to recognize things on its own, without barcodes or labels. It's called deep learning, and it's radically different from what's come before.
It really doesn't look like a computer program.
Gary Marcus is a psychologist at New York University who doesn't work with LeCun. He says ordinary computer code is written in very strict logical steps. If the scan shows Cheerios, then charge $4.49.
But what you'll see in deep learning is something different. You don't have a lot of instructions that say, if one thing is true, do this other thing.
Instead of linear logic, deep learning is loosely based on theories of how the human brain works. The program is a sprawling tangle of connections. It learns by rearranging those connections after each new experience. Now, Marcus says the idea of a self-reorganizing computer isn't entirely new. It's actually based on a machine from the 1950s called the perceptron. But by using new supercomputers and giant databases of images, deep learning programs are getting way past supermarket scanner territory. Jan LeCun exposed one of his programs to a huge database filled with random pictures.
On the order of 1.5 million images.
After going through every picture in the database, the program could identify pretty much everything. Things I've never even heard of.
Do you know what a langur is?
Not a clue.
Okay, it's a particular type of monkey. And you show it a picture of a langur and it'll tell you it's a langur. Or Samoyed, you know what a Samoyed is? Or Samoyed, I don't know how you pronounce it. That's actually a breed of dog and it will tell you it's a Samoyed. It won't tell you it's a dog, it will tell you that's this breed of dog.
What's more, the computer didn't have to have a close-up of the dog. It could identify one even if it was hiding under a chair. LeCun's program was so good, it got Facebook's attention. Late last year, he got a call from Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg. LeCun says the conversation was deep.
A lot of it was about philosophy, really. How do we go about building intelligent machines? Is it a good idea to try to build intelligent machines to help Facebook's business?
At the end of the call, LeCun got a new job. He's now director of AI research at Facebook. Google's also hired deep learning researchers, but Gary Marcus says there are limits to what deep learning can do. It can hear words, for example, but it can't really understand what a sentence means.
Google, I think, would like to build search engines that really understand the English language, and deep learning is not really powerful enough to do that. But it's powerful enough to help with a lot of things.
Google and Facebook have big plans for deep learning. In the next few years, they will use these programs to better recognize your voice, the people in your pictures, and a whole lot more. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
More and more people are watching television shows streamed over the internet through services like Netflix and Amazon Prime. These programs take up a huge amount of digital bandwidth, and that's led to a big dispute between these services and the internet service providers that carry them. NPR's Jim Zaroli explains.
At their home in New Jersey, Susie Felber and her family watch a lot of streaming video over the internet.
In fact, my kids have no idea. They're only just learning what a commercial is, and they start screaming when they come on. They think the TV's broken.
The Felbers access the internet through Verizon Fios, and it's worked pretty well, until recently, that is. Felber says a few days ago she and her husband were trying to watch the blockbuster Netflix series House of Cards, and something weird happened.
It went from high def to low def, but it wasn't high def very much, and then it was pixelating. like the game Minecraft. It was just little boxes. It looked sort of like when we tried to watch video on the internet in 1998.
Anecdotally, at least, the same thing appears to have happened to a lot of Netflix customers in recent days, just as the second season of House of Cards was being released. Richard Broughton, head of broadband at IHS, says programs like these take up a lot of digital bits and bytes.
As these are really taking off, and as people watch more and more video, obviously, that means that the effect is multiplied many, many times over. And it's this that's causing the apparent strain on the networks.
And this has provoked a simmering conflict between video companies like Netflix and the internet service providers they rely on. Big ISPs like Verizon have made no secret of the fact that they resent the huge strain on their networks caused by companies like Netflix. Jeff Silva is a telecommunications analyst at Medley Group Advisors.
Just using the Netflix example, uses a lot of bandwidth and it takes money and a lot of infrastructure to support that. And it also has implications for the rest of the traffic.
Critics suggest these big ISPs aren't building out their networks enough to keep pace with the huge growth in demand. Many critics say the company can get away with this because U.S. providers don't face a lot of real competition. One of the ways that internet companies have flexed their muscle involves something called peering. Again, Jeff Silva.
It's one of those components of the internet that you don't hear as much about, but it's pretty integral to how the internet works.
Peering is a way for internet companies to share bandwidth when they need it. Verizon has had a peering agreement with an internet provider named Cogent, but the two companies have had a dispute over who should pay for network improvements, and Cogent has accused Verizon of doing things that clogged up internet traffic. Verizon denies that. Richard Broughton says there was a similar dispute in South Korea a few years ago, and it was ultimately arbitrated by the government. And he says the same thing may have to happen now.
Certainly, I think there's a role for regulatory intervention to ensure that both parties are getting a fair deal out of it, that consumers get access to the services they want to.
But such an intervention seems unlikely. U.S. regulators and internet providers are locked in a bitter legal battle over the issue of net neutrality. It's essentially a fight over whether companies like Verizon and Comcast can favor some content providers over others. The courts recently issued a ruling siding with the internet companies, but the Federal Communications Commission made clear this week it hasn't given up on its efforts to enforce net neutrality. Meanwhile, the full promise of video streaming remains on hold, even as it grows more and more popular with consumers. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
If your credit card information was recently stolen, the man we'll meet next might have seen it. He will be our guide on a trip to a criminal corner of the internet.
People use malware, malicious software, to suck up credit card information or bank account numbers. Some of those numbers go up for sale, hawked in a hidden online marketplace before the rest of us even knew a mega breach happened.
A man who found out how to visit such a marketplace took Arthi Shahani along for the ride.
At a crowded Starbucks in downtown San Francisco, Tom Pagler powers up his laptop and takes me online shopping with a twist. We go to the anonymous Tor network to a website that requires a login.
I don't want to say the name, though.
Pagler doesn't want to tip off anyone because being a trusted user on a criminal website takes work. It's a lot like eBay. You've got to visit, buy and sell regularly, and get rated and reviewed by your peers.
When they transact with you, no one's getting arrested. No one's getting burned. So every time you make a transaction on the underground, you're just building your street cred.
Today, credit cards are on super sale. Pagler says that means a big breach just happened. I noticed something strange. Platinum credit cards are selling for less money than gold cards. Apparently, people in the underground don't just look at credit limits. They do analytics to see, according to the data, which banks have the weakest security.
For them, they'll know, based on bank ID number, which bank it is and where they're getting the best return on fraud.
Pagler is not actually a cyber criminal. He's a former Secret Service agent who studied them and is now in the private sector at DocuSign. Today, he's showing me how a low-level operator would work this site. Say I wanted to launch an attack. Without any specialized coding skills, I could buy the package of services I need, a list of 10,000 emails customized by age, gender, region that goes for $79. And to make sure the emails work,
there's a cleaning price, which is $48.
For another $50, I get the malware I need to latch into a victim's operating system and follow every keystroke in search of strings that look like bank logins and account numbers. It has a funny name. Keylogger, like logging my keys.
Exactly, like logging what you type.
I'd pay with an account that's like PayPal, except it's internet cash that's hard to trace back, and the servers are overseas, so American police can't really subpoena records. I also need one more item called a botnet, a vast network of computers under the control of a single bot master. Pagler hands me off to his colleague and botnet specialist, Tom Brandel, who shows me options as cheap as $16. He also makes this simple analogy to the drug trade.
These would actually be the guys on the street corners collecting money and distributing the drugs.
The bots send out emails. About 5 to 10% of poor souls open the attachment, which lets the crooks in. The bots crawl around waiting for bank passwords. Then they can drain the money into the overseas account. Millions upon millions of unsuspecting computers, maybe even yours and mine, are part of botnets, making it nearly impossible to find the real criminal.
If I'm the bank, I go back and say, hey, I saw this login from this address. I go to check that address and it belongs to your grandmother in Sioux Falls. Basically, the trail is dead at that point.
This is crime without risk.
Giovanni Vigna is a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who studies cybercrime.
If you look at the size of what gets stolen, I mean, there are wildly varying estimates. We're talking about billions. And you think about how many actual convictions there have been, it's amazingly low.
The incentives to join the underground are amazingly high. With just a couple $100, I could drain enough accounts to make $500,000 and grab data to resell on the hidden websites. For NPR News, I'm Aarti Shahani in San Francisco.